Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel 7, middle of the chapter, verses 13 through 28. I will entitle this session, The Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. In our last chapter, we talked about the four beasts in Daniel's night vision. We explained that the first beast, the lion, was the Babylonian Empire. The second beast, the bear, was the Medo-Persian Empire. The third beast, the leopard, was Alexander the Great's Macedonian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the successor kingdoms. And the fourth kingdom was the Roman Empire, all of whom were destroyed by the fifth kingdom, which is the kingdom of God. This vision occurred in the first year of Belshazzar, who began his regency in 553 BC. So we are now about a decade and a half before Babylon is going to be destroyed, or not destroyed, but conquered by the Persian Empire in 539 BC. So we start now in Daniel 7, verse 13 and 14. I continued watching in the night visions, and I saw one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was escorted before him. He was given authority to rule and glory and a kingdom, so that those of every people, nation, and language should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. Now, we need to remember that this famous vision of the Ancient of Days occurred in the same vision that Daniel had of the monstrous beast with the ten horns and the little horn that came out of the ten horns. Same vision. And I also need to point out, as we go through the rest of this chapter, that one's eschatological presuppositions will govern how you determine what's happening here. I am a post-mill. I am not a pre-mill, so I will interpret it from that viewpoint, and I will take a few pot shots at futurist interpretations or historicist interpretations as we go through. I hope you don't mind. In verse 13, Daniel saw one like a son of man. Now, what does like mean? It could mean in Daniel's vision that Jesus was not really incarnate. He only appeared in a human form in the vision. It could mean that like means exactly like a son of man. In other words, exactly like a human. Or it could mean he was analogically like a man, but the man that Daniel was looking at in the dream was more than a man. He was coming with the clouds of heaven, which would denote his majesty, his visibility, his swiftness, his glory. Well, I don't get too hung up on that. But let's take this title, Son of Man. It's not capitalized in the Holman Christian Study Bible, but Jesus referred to himself, according to Guzik, over 80 times in the New Testament as Son of Man. Nobody else did except Stephen in Acts 7 when he was being stoned. Jesus wanted to identify himself with this prophecy in Daniel 7:13. So this is an extremely famous prophecy here in Daniel 7:13, one like a son of man. Now, that phrase is somewhat mysterious. I did a bunch of looking on the internet, and I came up with sort of a summary of what son of man was. Let me read that to you now. Many have said that Jesus used this phrase to emphasize his humanity, the Jewish idiom used son of to show a close and intimate connection with, like the sons of thunder, James and John, son of Zebedee, sons of thunder. They were close and intimate with thunder. Therefore, a son of man is someone who is human, who has humanity. There is nothing wrong with this idea as long as one does not use it to detract from Jesus' divinity. After all, Jesus uses the phrase of himself when he forgave sins in Mark 2:10. But so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. That was the story of the leper being let down through the roof in Capernaum. Not the leper, I'm sorry, the paralytic. Continuing on with my summary. However, ironically, the phrase Son of Man is actually used by Jesus to emphasize his divinity. He got the phrase from Daniel 7:13 and 14. And behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. This reference is the only relevant use of the phrase Son of Man in the Old Testament. There is another irrelevant use of the phrase in Psalm 144, verse 3. From the context, it is obvious that Daniel is using the term of someone divine. The Son of Man was presented before God the Father, the Ancient of Days, and the Son of Man was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. But we know even more than we can get from the context. Daniel was a prisoner of the Babylonians during the famous Jewish Babylonian exile, which started in 586 BC. In old Babylonian, the phrase son of man meant heir to royalty. So when Daniel used the term was functionally equivalent to saying that the one like a son of man is rightful heir and successor to the divine throne. Son of man is essentially the same as son of God in this context. In the New Testament, no one called Jesus the son of man with the exception of Stephen as he was being stoned in Acts 7. Jesus used it of himself all the time. He is recorded as doing this about 90 times in the Gospels. Guzik says 80. Who's counting? So every time he used it, he was essentially saying, I am God, and I will inherit a kingdom and have dominion forever and ever, and I will establish that kingdom by coming on the clouds in judgment upon my enemies. It is debated whether the Jews in Jesus' day actually were using the phrase Son of Man as a messianic term. Regardless of how the Jews used the phrase, Jesus at least initiated the use of the phrase as referring to the divine Messiah, if he didn't appropriate a phrase already in use. So, to summarize, Son of Man equals Son of God equals God. Jesus is claiming divinity here, or he's using the phrase that Daniel saw in his vision, or that Daniel used to describe his vision. He's using that phrase, Jesus is, to claim divinity. Now, the Son of Man in Daniel's vision came up to the throne where the Ancient of Days was, and he came up with clouds of heaven around him, with the clouds of heaven. Now, that phrase, clouds of heaven, is important. Jesus used that phrase to describe his kingship and also the destruction of apostate Jerusalem in AD 70, which was trying to hinder his kingship of the establishment of the Christian church, the kingdom of God. Jesus is before the Jewish high priest in Matthew 26, verses 63 through 64. We read this, but Jesus kept silent. Then the high priest said to him, by the living God, I place you under oath. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. You have said it, Jesus told him. And that's a Jewish idiom. It means, yes, I am. But I tell you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, Jesus took the phrase and he adapted it a little bit. In the vision of Daniel, the Son of Man was going up to the throne of God. Here, Jesus is telling that the Son of Man is going to come down from the throne and whack the apostate Jewish kingdom, of which the high priest was a representative. And of course, I'm taking an Orthodox preterist view of this, no high priest would be able to see Jesus coming back and establishing his kingdom with the clouds of heaven off into the far distant future because they would all be dead. But Jesus said, I'm telling you, you will see it. And by the way, the you is plural. That means you, the high priest, and all you people around, you're going to see it. You're going to see me coming. And of course, the coming was not a physical, literal coming, but it was a coming to judge the kingdom, which was now trying to judge Jesus. So the coming on the clouds of heaven was to show authority, judgment, and the establishment of Jesus' kingdom, because once the apostate Jewish kingdom was judged, then Jesus' kingdom, the kingdom of the church, could be established. Now, in the vision in Daniel, Jesus is invested with his kingdom, and he does that by coming up to the throne of the Ancient of Days. Now, what does this coming refer to? Let me give you three options. Option number one, it refers to his first coming in the flesh from heaven down to earth to become incarnate in the Virgin Mary's womb. The problem with that is, in the incarnation, he was coming from the Father. He's not coming to the Father. So I will toss that option. Option number two, this refers to his ascension to heaven, his exaltation and session at the right hand of God, sitting at the right hand of God, which of course happened 50 days after his crucifixion, or I should say 50 days after his resurrection, at which time he inherited the kingdom of the church, and I think that's the proper view. Option number three, this is a futurist option. This refers to when Jesus ascended to heaven to take the kingdom after his second coming. In other words, Jesus comes back usually before the millennium, according to most futurists. This is after the church age. He receives his kingdom by going up to heaven to get it. But there's a problem with that. First of all of this is done in the context of the destruction of the Roman Empire. There's no Roman Empire at the second coming of Christ. So you have to posit a revived Roman Empire, quote unquote, revived. That's total speculation. The word revived Roman Empire and the concept of revived Roman Empire, neither one of those are in the Bible. Now, you have to posit this revived Roman Empire because the Stone Kingdom, which we talked about earlier, when the stone from the mountain comes and smashes the toes of the iron and clay of the four metal man in Daniel 2. That comes right after the Roman Empire in that vision, so we would assume it comes right after it in the vision of the four beasts. And so you got Jesus coming up at the second coming rather than receiving his kingdom at the beginning of the first coming. And that fits with millennial speculations. But in order to have those millennial speculations reasonably, you have to assume there's a Roman Empire, because all of this prophecy is obviously at the end of the Roman Empire, the four beasts and the fourth metal. But there is no Roman Empire, so you have to come up with a revived Roman Empire. Doesn't that sound like special pleading to you? It does to me. There's another problem with saying that Jesus is getting his kingdom here from the Ancient of Days at the beginning of the millennium, after his second coming, at the beginning of the pre-mill millennium, which happens after the second coming on that theory. This vision appears to be in heaven, not on a millennial earth. But Jesus, according to the theory, he's already come back to establish a millennial earth. He's on the earth when the millennium starts, but all of a sudden he's got to go take a side trip up to heaven to get his kingdom. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, of course, that argument works against pre-mills. You could be a non-pre-mill futurist who says that Jesus is inheriting his kingdom in the final state at the end of the church age rather than at the beginning. But then, again, where's the Roman Empire? There's no revived Roman Empire. So this is so much easier just to say this is Jesus inheriting his kingdom, a dominion which will last forever and ever, eternally, forever and ever, and that's the church. That's us. It's a kingdom, so that those of every people, nation, and language, that's all the peoples of the earth, should serve him, should serve the Son of Man, should serve Jesus. His dominion, his rulership, his monarchy, his kingdom is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. The church will never pass away. And his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. The church will never be destroyed. Now there's an eschatology of victory. There is an eschatology of hope. An eschatology that does not consist of polishing the brass rails of a sinking ship. An eschatology of Christians huddled down. Will the Son of Man, when he comes back, will he find faith on the earth? An eschatology of nuclear bombs, nuclear fallout making the moon blood red, the rivers polluted by nuclear fallout, 200 billion man armies coming from China, the Antichrist ruling over a global world government that makes you have a chip in your hand with 666 on it in order to get fed, and all this other, excuse me for being polemical here, bullshitki that is being purveyed to the body of Christ as truth. No, this is a kingdom that Jesus is going to inherit. Get myself worked up here. I'll have to go back to professorial objective mode here, and we will, in just a minute, move on to Daniel 7:15. But before I leave polemical mode here, let's look at verse 14. Those of every people, nation, and language should serve him. That's a great evangelistic verse. That's a great verse to comfort Christians to say, hey, we are a member of a church from every tribe on the planet that serves Jesus. No, we can't use that. That's the millennium. Doesn't apply to you. That's what the futurists do, see? They take away all the great promises of the church, and they park them up there in the millennium where we can't get at them. Also in verse 14, Daniel says, Jesus' dominion, or the Son of Man's dominion, is an everlasting dominion. Well, did Jesus only have dominion at the beginning of the millennium at his second coming, or did he have his dominion at the beginning of the first coming? He had it during his earthly ministry at his first coming, Matthew 28:18. Then Jesus came near and said to them, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And I'm assuming that means when he's about to ascend, it's about to be given to him at the ascension. So Jesus had the dominion when he came to the earth. Why do we need to put his dominion off way off into the fuzzy future? Now, this dominion, this kingdom, which is the church, the New Covenant church, it will not pass away. It will not be destroyed. That distinguishes Jesus' spiritual kingdom from all other earthly kingdoms. Daniel's four earthly kingdoms were different. Babylon, Persia, Alexander the Great, Greek, and Rome. They didn't cover the whole world, but they all came to an end. Jesus' kingdom will cover the whole world, but it's not going to end. We go now to Daniel 7, verses 15 through 16. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was deeply distressed within me, and the visions in my mind terrified me. I approached one of those who were standing by and asked him the true meaning of all this, so he let me know the interpretation of these things. Now, why was Daniel deeply distressed? Because of his lack of understanding. He probably figured, why in the world is God giving me this vision? Daniel's a curious guy, so he approached one of those who were standing by. That's probably an angel in the vision, not somebody in his bedroom, and asked him the true meaning. Daniel did. He said, let me know the interpretation of these things. And again, that's in the vision, not in the bedroom in actuality. We go now to Daniel 7, verses 17 through 18. These huge beasts, now this is the standing by one, probably an angel, explains things to Daniel. These huge beasts, four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth. But the holy ones of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. That's contrasting the church with all these great pagan empires. Kind of encouraging. The weak will inherit the earth. The meek will inherit the earth. Now the huge beast, from Nebuchadnezzar's view in chapter 2, were four kingdoms, and they were stately, they were noble. It was the statue that had the stature of a man. That's how Nebuchadnezzar received the vision, the dream. But from God's view, the four pagan nations were ferocious beasts, nothing noble about them at all. Now in verse 17, the angel tells Daniel, these four kings will rise from the earth. That's as opposed to the eternal kingdom which the saints will receive. That kingdom is heavenly. And again, the four beasts, let me repeat, Babylon, Persia, Greece under Alexander the Great, and Rome. But the holy ones of the Most High will receive the kingdom, since the Roman Empire is gone. Because remember, in this vision, in our last audio, first part of chapter 7, the beast was destroyed. Daniel 7, verse 11, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to the burning fire, thrown into the lake of fire, in other words, to put it in terms of Revelation 20, I think it is. We go now to Daniel 7, verses 19 through 22. Daniel continues, then I wanted to know the true meaning of the fourth beast, the one different from all the others, extremely terrifying, with iron teeth and bronze claws, devouring, crushing, and trampling with its feet whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head, and about the other horn that came up, before which three fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke arrogantly, and that was more visible than the others. As I was watching, this horn waged war against the holy ones, against the saints, and was prevailing over them until the Ancient of Days arrived and a judgment was given in favor of the holy ones of the Most High. For the time had come and the holy ones took possession of the kingdom. Now, why did Daniel single out the Roman Empire as an empire for which he wanted more information? Well, in the vision, it was a monstrous beast. It had great destructive power. It had a conspicuous horn, the little horn. It also had 10 horns. And plus, in the vision, the little horn waged war against the saints, and that means a lot to Daniel because he represents God's people. Now, in verse 19, remember, this is the Roman Empire. This fourth beast had teeth of iron and claws of bronze, which showed the Roman Empire's strength, its voraciousness, its cruelty. And the Holman Christian Study Bible translates saints as holy ones. Remember, when we read holy ones, we mean saints. Verse 21, the horn, that's the little horn, which I said in my previous audio is either Vespasian or Nero. I'm leaning towards Nero the more I think about it. So let's assume this is Nero waging war against the saints. Nero did that after the famous fire in Rome. He blamed the Christians for the fire and persecuted them terribly, persecuted the Christians horribly for 3.5 years, from 64 till 68, when Nero committed suicide. We've already said the 10 horns were the first 10 emperors of the Roman Empire, from Julius Caesar all the way down to Vespasian. And the little horn that rose out of the 10 horns was Nero, or Vespasian, but most probably Nero. Vespasian also waged war against the saints for 3.5 years during the Jewish War. And that's why sometimes it makes it a little difficult to choose between Nero and Vespasian as who this little horn is. But at any rate, that little horn waged war against the saints and was winning. Until God arrived, the Ancient of Days arrived, and a judgment was given in favor of the holy ones, of the saints. Nero's gone, but the saints are still here. Vespasian's gone, but the saints are still here. And by the way, if it's Vespasian waging war against the saints, it would have to be the Jewish saints, most probably. Although it was also Christian saints who were having war waged against them by Vespasian during the Jewish War. But it's easier to say Nero. He waged war against the saints, but guess what? The time had come and the saints took possession of the kingdom. That's the establishment of the Church of Jesus Christ. What could be easier in this fog of eschatological confusion that we evangelical Christians are constantly walking around in? We go down to Daniel 7, 23 through 27. This is what he said. This is the angel standing by Daniel. He explains to Daniel, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, different from all the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth. The Roman Empire conquered much of the known world, lasted for about 1,000 years or so, depending on how you want to measure the empire. But it's a long time. It will devour the whole earth, trample it down, and crush it. The 10 horns or 10 kings will rise from this kingdom. Already talked about that. Jessica, I'm going to show off a little bit here. King number 1, Emperor number 1, Julius Caesar. Number 2, Octavius. Number 3, Tiberius. Number 4, Caligula. Number 5, Claudius. Number 6, Nero. Number 7, Galba. Number 8, Otho. Number 9, Vitellius. And number 10, Vespasian. I could also tell you number 11, Titus, but he's not relevant. But those 10 kings lasted all the way through till near the end of the Jewish war, and so they're relevant to what's going on here. When you study prophecy enough, you'll learn the first 10 emperors. I never have memorized a list of the 10 emperors just by going it over it and over it and over it again, reading about it. Pretty soon, those emperors start to become real. In verse 24, the angel continues explaining to Daniel, another horn, different from the previous ones, will rise after them and subdue 3 kings. We've already said that's probably Nero. That word after there is a problem. If you think of the horns in Daniel's vision as appearing sequentially, starting with Julius Caesar and ending up with Vespasian. Vespasian's number 10, Nero's number 6, so Nero doesn't come after the 10 horns in sequential order. But if you picture the 10 horns popping up on the heads of that beast in Daniel's vision happening all at once, then you would read it this way. Another horn, different from the previous ones, will rise after those horns rise on the beast head. It's very easy to interpret it that way. That is from James Jordan, the Orthodox Preterist theologian. Verse 25, the little horn, I'm assuming it's Nero, will speak words against the Most High and oppress the holy ones of the Most High. The saints are oppressed by Nero. We know all about that, how Nero would go down into prisons and sexually molest prisoners, how he would wrap Christians up in animal skins, soak the animal skins in oil and light them up while he's eating a banquet as the Christians burned around him. He was an animal. And this man, this little horn, will intend to change religious festivals and laws, and the holy ones will be handed over to him for a time, times and half a time. Between 64 and 69, there's your 3.5 years, time, times and half a years. Nero, how did he try to change religious festivals and laws? Well, Nero started the Jewish war. He's trying to wipe out the Jewish religion. And if it's Vespasian, that's the little horn. Vespasian was the general in charge of fighting the Jews in the Jewish war. They were trying to wipe out the Jewish religion. That's how they changed laws and religious festivals. Now, historicists say that the changing of times and festivals was done by the Pope. The changing of religious festivals and laws was done by the Pope. And in fact, say Seventh-day Adventists, for example, well-known historicist, they say the Pope switched the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. And so now many Seventh-day Adventists believe Sunday worship is the mark of the Antichrist. Ooh, that means all Presbyterians are marked with the Antichrist. An example of foolish eschatological speculation. Historicists say that the Pope changed the calendar so certain days were important. There were holy days for saints. They were very famous for that. Some days for abstinence from meats, etc. Well, no. Let's just don't even consider that. John Gill says this changing of laws and religious festivals means to alter the forms and constitutions of kingdoms and the customs and usages of them, yea, to set up and pull down kings at pleasure. It sounds to me like Gill is saying that this little horn is not going to just change Jewish festivals and laws, but he's going to change festivals and laws of all the kingdoms that the Roman Empire conquers. I don't think so. Religious festivals, that sounds like Jewish stuff to me. But at any rate, Nero tried to do that. Vespasian tried to do it too. Futurists, by the way, say that this changing of religious festivals and laws refers to the revived Roman Empire, ruled over by the Antichrist, I suppose. They will persecute the Empire, and the Antichrist will persecute tribulation saints. If you see that word, tribulation saints, That's a made-up word for the use of dispensationalist. If you're not a dispensationalist, you don't ever need to say that word. So in verse 27, the kingdom, the dominion, the greatness of the kingdom will be given to the holy ones of the Most High. When did that happen? I've been trying to convince you that that's when the church gets started. The futurists say no, it refers to the millennial saints, and we Christians down here are just in a gap, a parenthesis. We don't get to use this verse to show that the kingdom is ours. Now in verse 27, this kingdom will be given to the people, by God, to the people. Premills use this verse to oppose the post-millennial view. Premills say that the kingdom is received, not achieved. Premills say that the church does not convert the world to Jesus' kingdom in order to give the kingdom to Jesus. Rather, Jesus gives the kingdom to the church. Of course, post-mills do say that we do the work of evangelism, and then after it's finished, Jesus comes back once the number of the elect is filled up. In my humble opinion, that's a weak argument, because whether it's a premillennial in the future thousand-year kingdom given to the people, or whether it's the Church of Jesus Christ having a kingdom, it all comes from God. That kingdom is given to the people because God gives. We don't earn. Now, in verse 25, this little horn, either Nero or Vespasian, will oppress the holy ones of the Most High. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. But the Holman Christian Study Bible note says, wear out, and so does the King James. I like the King James translation. He will speak words against the Most High, against God, and wear down the holy ones of the Most High. Wear down. The word, the Greek word, means to wear down to nothing through friction, to harass the holy ones, the saints, to harass them continually so that life becomes a wretched existence. That's what Nero did between 64 and 68, 3.5 years, times time and half a time. Now, I'm going to read verse 26 in order to present another futurist argument, which I'm going to take a pot shot at, again, if you don't mind. Verse 26, but the court will convene. This is the court over which the Ancient of Days was ruling. But the court will convene, and his dominion will be taken away. That's the little horn, Nero. His dominion will be taken away to be completely destroyed forever. Now, John Walvoord, the famous dispensationalist, says this concerning that. He opposes a preterist view of Nero. He says the kingdom of Rome was conquered so slowly by the church that history doesn't fit this prophecy. History shows a long, drawn-out process by which the Roman Empire was beaten by the Christians, but Daniel presumes a quick, sudden judgment of the Roman Empire. Let me quote to you from Walvoord. It is questionable whether the Roman Empire had any serious opposition from the Christian Church, or that the growing power of the Church contributed in a major way to its downfall. The Roman Empire never had any serious opposition from the Christian Church? The growing power of the Church did not contribute in a major way to its downfall? In my humble opinion, that's an absurd statement. Read history. I mean, didn't Augustine write a whole book trying to prove that it was not the Christian church that caused the Roman Empire to get destroyed? As the Christians went around conquering paganism, and pretty soon the pagan beliefs went by the wayside and the Roman Empire fell? Oh no, that had nothing to do with the church. The Roman Empire didn't have any serious opposition from the church. The Roman Empire that held up pagans, the Roman Empire which held up pagan gods for worship, including emperors, and the Christian church didn't have anything to do with the Roman church falling. I don't know what Walvoord is thinking about. Must have had a bad day when he wrote that. But the answer to this futurist argument, and you do hear this a lot, the fact that the Roman Empire took so long to go down. Verse 26 says, the dominion of the little horn, that would be Nero, will be taken away. Now, if you take that as the Roman Empire, well then, it would take a long time for it to go down, but so what? The prophecy doesn't say how quickly the Roman Empire goes down. It just says the Roman Empire will be completely destroyed forever, quote unquote. Not how long it takes to destroy the Roman Empire, but if you take the taken away to refer to the dominion of the little horn, it says, and his dominion, the little horn's dominion, which we have stated was either Nero or Vespasian, if it's taken away, that did happen suddenly. I mean, Nero killed himself in 68 AD. Vespasian died in 79 AD. That didn't take forever. That's a foolish argument. So we go now to the last verse in Daniel 7. Daniel continues, "This is the end of the interpretation. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts terrified me greatly, and my face turned pale. But I kept the matter to myself." Why was Daniel terrified? Well, Daniel would be worried over what the little horn in particular was going to do to his people, wear out the saints for times, times, and half a time. That would make Daniel nervous. After all, Daniel loves his Jewish people. He's totally identified with them. And not only that, that fourth beast out of which the little horn sprang was awful ferocious. Bronze claws, iron feet. I'm getting the two visions mixed up, I'm sorry. Iron teeth and bronze claws. The Roman Empire in the Four Metal Man had iron feet and legs, half iron, half clay feet and iron legs, but this is iron teeth and bronze claws. Iron is powerful. It'll chew you up. Bronze claws will grab you. So yeah, Daniel's worried about that because it looks like the saints are going to be attacked by something that's pretty monstrous. So no, of course he was terrified. And of course his face turned pale. I'm sure that's after he woke up. But I kept the matter to myself. Here's some options as to why. These are my speculations. If Daniel had told Belshazzar, the ruling regent, what the vision was, Belshazzar might have figured out that Babylon was doomed. Remember, the lion has gone down a long time before we get to the fourth monster beast. And if Babylon was doomed and Belshazzar figured it out, Belshazzar might have blamed Daniel for having that kind of a vision. Another possible reason, this is my speculation, take it with a grain of salt, people might have thought Daniel was crazy. However, Daniel already had a good reputation for dream interpretation. They might not have thought he was crazy. So I think that mainly Daniel kept it to himself, because you talk about regime change on that monstrous order, that would get the powers to be a little bit upset. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with Daniel 7. We're now ready to go to Daniel 8, which I will entitle The Ram and the Goat. I hope you continue with me, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.